Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Dr. Nick, the Incrementalist. Join me as I seek out the small incremental changes being applied in other industries that we can learn from and that can be applied in healthcare. Can these changes bring immediate value, but also add up to the big improvements and revolution we need in healthcare? Come along with me to explore the possibilities. My innovative guests from around the globe have used small incremental improvements to achieve their moonshot. And today, I'm delighted to be joined by Dr. Maria Panagiotti. She is a senior lecturer at the University of Manchester and part of the Greater Manchester Patient Safety Translational Research Centre. Maria, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much for inviting me to this fascinating interview. And I'm really delighted to talk to you today about this important issue about patient harm and medical errors.
Fantastic. So for the benefit of the listeners, could you share a little bit of your background? You're currently a senior lecturer. You have a PhD in clinical psychology. Tell us a little bit about how you got there.
Well, my background, as you mentioned before, I'm a psychologist. And after that, I moved in an environment with doctors and working in primary care as well as hospitals. And we're trying using psychology as well as the medical knowledge to understand how common is medical errors are in healthcare, as well as which of them are leading to patient harm, and how we can actually use evidence-based approaches to reduce patient harm in their interactions with the healthcare system.
Fantastic. So obviously with this perspective of psychology, and I think in some respects we're all simple psychologists, or at least we aspire to be, in terms of understanding human nature and trying to understand and navigate our way. And the reason we ended up connected was thanks to a paper that you just recently published. It was called The Prevalence and Severity and Nature of Preventable Patient Harm Across the Medical Care Setting. You essentially did a systematic review of harm. Tell us a little bit about that study, what you did, and what were some of the findings and key insights?
Well, the current evidence so far shows that medical errors are common, and at least some of them are leading to some type of patient harm. The problem is that we don't know how much of this patient harm is actually can actually be prevented by implementing a specific quality improvement program or by intervening in the process. So in order to actually reduce patient harm, we need to know what types of harm, how common is the preventable patient harm, what types of incidents are leading to patient harm, and who is involved in this process, so that both patients, health professionals, and the healthcare system can be properly supported to prevent the harm for patients.
So as you think about that a little bit, so it's worth maybe digging into that to help people understand when you talk about preventable versus non-preventable. Can you give us some examples of that?
Well, for example, let's say that if one patient goes with particular complaints about having, let's say, the bipolar diagnosis, for example, having a mental health diagnosis, and because they don't have very good communication skills and they can't really discuss with their physician properly, the physician is giving them a wrong diagnosis of depression, and they're putting in a wrong medication, which actually, instead of improving their diagnosis, is actually making things worse.
Right.
So this is a type of error that can be preventable because it's caused by a miscommunication between patients and doctors. In other circumstances, for example, one medicine might have some adverse events on adverse reactions for a patient, but this is hardly predictable. So their physician and the system cannot really predict how the patient is going to react to the specific medicine, especially if they have multiple conditions and they having also many are also taking many other different medications. So although they understand the risk, and usually the risk is really low, there is a small percentage of patients who actually have these adverse direct reactions. But these are not always predictable. This is one type, let's say, of non-preventable patient harm that we can do very little to improve the situation.
So it's interesting you talk about that as, it's predictable, but not necessarily preventable. And
exactly.
And that's essentially because it's this is a spectrum, or essentially a range. So for one individual, they may or may not have that side effect or adverse reaction, as you describe. And I think you even talk about it in terms of venous thrombus embolism. So yes. Getting clots and what many people would know or understand as DVTs. And we essentially anticoagulate or thin the blood. But that comes with a potential adverse reaction. Not everybody gets it. But if you get that reaction, that's not actually patient harm, or at least preventable harm. Is that a fair sort of statement?
Exactly. Exactly. You have put it very, you have described it very well.
So it's still
important to quantify that, to even for things that we can't really intervene at this stage, at least to prevent specific incidents of harm. It's still important to record it, to have a figure about it, but in terms of prevention, it's more important to focus on types of instances that we can intervene now and prevent them.
And your classification, so again, to help people understand, how do you group these up? So in those instances where that's non-preventable, that's a bucket or a grouping that you sort of track and categorize, but that's different to preventable harm. Is that true?
Well, what we actually did is we were based, because this was a systematic review and meta-analysis, we're based on how the individual studies examined and classified preventability. This, across most of the studies, this was done by using a specific scale. So the authors typically used a 6-point scale where a team of health providers came together and they decided whether a specific type of harm. They decided that this incident led to some harm to patients. And then they come together and they decide whether if they were applying a different approach, if they were applying a different intervention, this harm could actually be prevented. And for the harms that were rated from 4 and above, means that they could be prevented. For harms that were rated below 4, means that very little could be done to be prevented.
So you obviously looked, and I think based on the paper, there was multiple studies you went across. This was a meta-analysis of multiple studies. Were you able to reconcile the scoring mechanisms? Were they all using the same scoring mechanisms in that approach?
Well, not all of them. As I said, most of them, at least 2/3 of them, they used a standard method of rating preventability. 1/3 of them, they didn't. They used different consensus methods between health professionals. However, in our analysis, we actually tried to control whether a different methods for assessing preventability had an impact on the results. And we didn't really find a particular impact. So this means that our findings are still the same across studies using different methods for assessing preventability.
Right. So having dug into this, what did you find? What was the output from this study?
Well, the main result of our analysis was that preventable harm was present at 6% of the cohort that we studied. It was 330,000 patients receiving care across different healthcare settings such as hospitals, primary care, intensive care and surgery, as well as obstetrics and emergency departments. So pulling them all together, 6% of the patients were actually having some preventable patient harm. The overall patient harm for these patients were 12%. So this means that at least half of the patient harm was preventable.
Oh, interesting. So you divided up that group and that 6% was preventable, but there was another 6% non-preventable or unpreventable. I'm almost getting confused with preventable or unpreventable, but not preventable at this point in time.
Yes, exactly. We found, to put it more clearly, 12% of patients experienced some type of harm during the healthcare interactions. 6% of these patients were actually experienced preventable patient harm.
Right. Okay, fantastic. So, and you know, I think what's interesting about that, particularly in the context of another interview that I did, where we were looking at the error meme that sort of talks about these just gargantuan numbers that rise to 60% of cases in hospitals, which just seems counterintuitive to me. This is much more in line. So there's a couple of studies certainly that were referenced in that. A UK study that was a retro case analysis of clinical notes that showed 3.6%, and a Norwegian one that talked about 4.2%. So for me, that feels much more in line, I think, you know, reasonable. But this was a meta-analysis versus an actual going and looking at the individual notes, correct?
Exactly. Exactly. Right. So we're relying on the data that individual authors have reported. And of course, our pooled estimates are based on pooling all the studies together. So there might be some difference according to the design that each study used, or even the population that they chose to study, or even the timing as well. For example, one study might have been based on reviewing the records of patients for 1 month, and another study might have been based on reviewing the records of patients for 1 year. So some of the difference might depend on how long, what was the timeline of the studies that they studied patient harm.
So as you looked at that and you looked at the source data, I think, again, some of the sort of insights that jumped out at me, first of all, sort of relatively focused on higher order medical systems with better resources, better care. Any thoughts about the international comparability in places where the healthcare is maybe not as well resourced, and they struggle just to sort of delivering? Do you have any sense of how this would be represented in countries like Africa, for instance?
That's a very good point. Our results are mainly based from studies based in the US and in Europe. We had very few studies, only 10%, I think, 10 or 14% of studies conducted in low and middle income countries. To be fully honest, there were more studies in those countries than the ones that we included. The problem was that the way that they reported preventability did not allow us to include this data into our analysis. And previous literature has shown that patient harm is higher in those contexts because, as you said, the systems are not well resourced, and it is likely that might be also very highly preventable as well, because right. They lack the basic support that we have in Europe and US.
Yeah, interesting. And then for those of you just joining, I'm talking to Dr. Maria Panagiotti. She's a senior lecturer at the University of Manchester and part of the Greater Manchester Patient Safety Translational Research Centre. We're talking about harm, and specifically preventable and non-preventable harm. And one of the things that I found really intriguing about some of the commentary and certainly the things that you and I had talked a little bit about was this concept of, could we prevent the non-preventable, which, you know, feels a little bit counterintuitive. And I'd love to hear you sort of explain what you mean by that and what the opportunity is there.
Well, the focus of this paper was first of all on preventable patient harm, because we understand that there is an opportunity there to target specific types of patient harm, such as medication, for example, and make real life improvements for patients, and also improve the satisfaction of healthcare professionals and the healthcare system. However, in my personal view is that we definitely need to quantify overall harm in general, because what now is considered non-preventable, with new methods and a new approach in the future, that can be preventable in the future. So we don't really need to, we should not really forget the proportion of harm which we consider non-preventable. We consider it now non-preventable because this is the way that our health system works. This is the way that we know how we organize healthcare. But with a different model in mind, some of these harms might actually be prevented. This is what I mean. And if we want to think a bit broadly, what medicine is doing across all times, really, is trying to treat untreated conditions. And this is how we should approach non-preventable harm, as an opportunity to develop new methods to prevent this harm for patients. This is exactly what medicine is about, anyway.
No, I agree, and I think that analogy is important to understand, because as I sort of I looked at that phrase and thought, no, that just doesn't make sense. And I think you described that entirely eloquently and accurately. It's exactly what we do in medicine, and you know, there's a perfect example of this that I recall from my time practicing clinical medicine. And you know, we would give drugs that induced nausea, and that's harm essentially if people are vomiting as a result of the treatment. And you know, today you think, well, this is really obvious, but at the time it wasn't. But actually giving antiemetics as part of that regime, as opposed to just giving the drug and then going, oh my goodness, you feel nauseous, we need to treat that, is one of the things. You know, it's a simple advance, it's a simple sort of concept, but it then just became part of the sort of natural standard of care and standard of practice. And I think that's the constant advancing nature of medicine. And you know, we should see harm and preventable harm in the same light. There's opportunities, and that's really the importance of this, is digging into it, because we should never be satisfied with whatever error rate unless it's zero. And you know, we strive to get to zero, but obviously that's a very, very difficult target. So what are the things that you think you learned through this process in terms of some of the currently preventable? Where are the opportunities that we can maybe start to apply and use the findings to improve the results in medicine?
Well, to be fully honest, I was expecting the result, the main results that we found about the percentage of harm, overall harm, the percentage of preventable harm. What I was not expecting was the lack of evidence in some particular settings. For example, a large majority of patients are treated in primary care, or they're treated in psychiatric settings. However, we have very little evidence about how prevalent the harm is in this setting, as well as what types of harms are occurring in those settings, because it might be different. For example, in psychiatry, we might have also the concept of psychological harm, which is also very important, but our current classification systems don't really take a lot of account about the psychological harm and these consequences. In primary care as well, there is a lot of discussion about diagnostic harm, because patients come with specific complaints, and the communication between the health providers and the patients is really key and can play a major role on whether or not a diagnosis is correct or not, based on the way that the patient and the health provider are communicating. And this was one important finding as well, because we found that although we found that diagnostic harm was lower than medication-related harm, it was more likely to be preventable. So there are some particular types of harm, such as diagnostic harm, which is really preventable and can be avoided if communication is better, really.
So a central theme in that, and I certainly saw something in your discussion post paper's findings, that centered on patient interaction and even patient reporting, which I think we're seeing, thankfully, a bigger shift towards patient engagement, not to use the buzzword inappropriately, but the inclusion of the patient in that gathering of the information. The thing that I'm curious about is how do you reconcile the challenge? So take the example we talked about with thrombus embolism. So if I'm a patient and I'm given anticoagulation, but I get a side effect of that that's predictable, how do we tease out the fact that the patient may perceive that to be harm and report it as such, but in actual fact, it's not really, not in the classification of preventable harm, it's really predictable. Where do you see that going? Because I think the patient inclusion in all of this is essential, particularly when you think about primary care, psychiatry much harder because maybe they don't, it's harder for them to sort of represent that, but, you know, another issue, but for the primary care.
Well, I think we underestimate the understanding and support that we can receive from patients. If a patient has experienced harm, it is very likely that they're going to they will know about it. And if they don't get the right information about it, this is where the problem arises. What we really need is to educate patients so that they can understand that they've got also some shared responsibility in what's happening in their healthcare. They might have a specific health provider, a specific physician that they treat them for years, but still, they need to take some actions such as checking the recipes, being as an active member in this healthcare process, not just taking the advice of the health professionals without doing any extra effort. We need to have this in place, and of course, we need training for health providers to improve their communication skills, because the way that an incident of harm is actually described to patients can make a massive difference on the way that is going to be perceived and the consequences that it's going to have for the patient as well as the health professional, because the health professional can also be seen as a victim in this process. It will be a huge mistake if we blame health professionals about errors. It's about improving that relationship and improving the support for both of them, because making a medical error is particularly distressing for physicians as well.
Yeah, it's interesting you bring that up. That's one of my sort of primary points around this error, is this blame storming that exists, that is counterproductive. And, you know, one of the reasons that you see the airline industry at Six Sigma of errors, and, you know, having driven out much of the error, although they're still imperfect, but they really have tried this no fault approach that says, you know, what is the root cause? Let's work towards improving that. How do we get there? You know, we've got a minute left. Any parting thoughts on how we approach that no blame? Because I feel like medicine still has, certainly in my experiences, there is an awful lot of this blame associated that sort of prevents us from getting to the root cause and improving things.
It's all about changing the culture in medical education and improving the collaboration and relationship between different health professionals who work in the same team. So instead of trying to be competitive and achieve excellence, it's more about trying to be partners in the same team and support each other. I think this is the crucial this is the crucial way forward, to understand that some errors are inevitable, and it's not about this the specific individual. It's more about the process of medicine. We are talking about a complex human. One person is a very complex mechanism anyway, so it's very difficult for someone to predict and completely minimize the possibility of a medical error. But what we can do, we can have a system in place where support is provided to all parties, really, to both the patients and the health providers, because otherwise we end up with dissatisfied patients and burnt out health professionals.
Both terrible outcomes.
Yes.
So, I unfortunately we've run out of time. I think that sort of closing point for me sort of really encapsulates the ultimate direction. You know, changing the culture, improving collaboration and communication, and, you know, focusing on cause and effect versus blaming. Just a delightful conversation. It just remains for me to thank you, Maria, for joining me today.
Thank you too. It was my pleasure.
Thanks for joining me today. Do you have any better ideas, or have you found a small incremental change that's brought about a big improvement in your world? Let's continue the conversation on our hashtag, The Incrementalist, or share with me at DrNick1 on Twitter. You can find more information about the show on our program page at healthcarenowradio.com. And tune in next time to hear my discussions with leaders and innovators from around the globe who've revolutionized their space by using small incremental improvements to achieve their moonshot. I'm Dr. Nick, the Incrementalist, and I'm starting a revolution through evolution.